Today on Against the Grain, brilliant theorist of nonviolent social change or Cold War defense intellectual and strategist? Gene Sharp has had a tremendous influence on the progressive ideas and activism since the early 1970s, and his ideas are so pervasive that at times they appear to be without a history, just part of the air that we breathe on the left. My guest, scholar Marcy Smith, aims to place Sharp back in his political context, taking his ideas seriously and seriously questioning them. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Political scientist Gene Sharp, who was born in 1928 and died 2 years ago in 2018, was one of the most influential thinkers on social movements and activism, not just in the United States, but around the world. He was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, received the Right Livelihood Award, was embraced by activists from Eastern Europe to the United States and beyond, and has inspired untold members of activists to engage in nonviolent action. In two extended essays, my guest, Marcy Smith, has written a deep exploration of Gene Sharp's intellectual and political trajectory and his enduring influence. In doing so, she's turned up many unsettling questions about Sharp's reputation on parts of the left, hoping to prompt a rethink of how progressives use his brand of nonviolence for social change. Marcy Smith is a lawyer and lecturer in economics at John Jay College in New York City. Marcy, let's start with Gene Sharp himself. Who was he, and what political world did he come out of?
So if you were to look into the mainstream media accounts of who Gene Sharp was, you'll read that he was a nonviolent warrior. He was a prophet of peace. He's cast as this sort of guru of nonviolent social movements. And indeed, he's credited with helping, not so much direct, but helping sort of intellectually inspire lots of nonviolent rebellions around the world, the so-called color revolutions abroad and here in the United States, things like Occupy Wall Street, the battle in Seattle. And he's written a lot. He wrote more than 20 books. Many of them have been translated into lots of different languages. He won the Right Livelihood Award. He was nominated for the Nobel Prize 4 times. So if you're looking into Sharp from mainstream media accounts, what it would seem is that he comes out of a world of sort of social activism. And indeed, he did maintain ties to social movements throughout his career, both domestically and abroad. And his early career, he worked with people like A.J. Mustey, who was a famous pacifist, Trotskyist turned pacifist, and worked for Peace News in the U.K. for a while. So he has these activist associations, and that is the story that typically gets emphasized about him. But my 4 years of research into Sharp reveals a more complicated story, number one, it shows that he's actually a really important Cold War defense intellectual. So beginning in the 60s, he is working at this institute called the Center for International Affairs at Harvard. This is a bulwark of the Cold War establishment. Its co-directors are Henry Kissinger, whom we all know, and Robert Bowie, who is the future deputy director of the CIA, Central Intelligence Agency. And indeed, there's this acronym they use for the Center for International Affairs at Harvard, the CIA at Harvard, which is sort of a, nudge, nudge, seems to be a kind of joke. It was founded by McGeorge Bundy, who was sort of the very important Cold War character. He would serve in multiple Cold War administrations. So Sharp is at this institute for 30 years, and he is developing his ideas about nonviolent action. He's sort of the grand strategist of nonviolent action. He's developing these ideas with monies from the Department of Defense, and is writing really to a defense audience. And so this is a very important dimension of who he is and the sort of milieu that he comes out of. And then he's also writing to some extent about state theory. So when we get into his theories more, we can talk about this. But he, for example, wrote a book called Social Power and Political Freedom in 1980. And this is a work of state theory where he's basically describing how the seat of violence in many cases is centralized state power. And so he's got this critique of centralized state power, which, according to him, is represented by or flows from government, excessive government activity in the economy, things like regulation, public ownership, quote-unquote controls over the economy, you know, conjuring sort of capital controls. You know, it's very clear that he has a sort of early neoliberal critique of government action in the economy. And he's writing this right as Reagan gets elected. And indeed, you know, he's going to start advancing his ideas about nonviolent action more deliberately the same year that the National Endowment for Democracy is funded and founded, and the Albert Einstein Institution, Gene Sharp's sort of vehicle for promoting his ideas, and the NED are actually started the very same year, and they will track together sort of around the world. This book, interestingly, its foreword was written by a libertarian senator. So there's also this dimension of Sharp. Marco Hatfield was his name. And there's this dimension of Sharp that, you know, politically he's got these associations with libertarians and neoliberals. So he founds the Albert Einstein Institution with Peter Ackerman, who at that time was working simultaneously at Drexel Burnham Lambert, which was this notorious investment house in the 1980s. Its principal was the fellow after whom Gordon Gekko was, the character in Wall Street was sort of based on, named Michael Milken. The junk bond king.
Yeah.
So innovators of the junk bond funded leveraged buyout, which played a big role in American deindustrialization. So Ackerman is alongside Sharp promoting these ideas about nonviolent action, and is also on the board of the Cato Institute and on the board of the Project for Social Security Choice, which is advocating the privatization of Social Security. So Sharp also has these sorts of associations. And then a third very important dimension of who Sharp is that via the Albert Einstein Institution, him and Sharp and others, Colonel Bob Helvey, who comes out of defense intelligence, who's a consultant for the Albert Einstein Institution, they are spreading the ideas that Sharp has spent his career developing around the world, training activists who are, quote-unquote, trying to promote democratic freedoms. And very tellingly, the countries where they focus their efforts are always in places where the sitting administrations, the sitting regimes, are resisting to some degree either the U.S. agenda geopolitically or the neoliberal restructuring that's being pushed by the Washington consensus. And meanwhile, U.S. client states are left, you know, unbothered. So, this is a pattern that's very clear just from reviewing the annual reports of the Albert Einstein Institution. So in the piece, I also argue that Sharp is a sort of quiet but vital counselor to very important anti-communist movements through the 80s, 90s, 2000s. But of course, it's still true that Sharp had a very important role that he played in domestic movements here in the United States. And part two of my research, which just came out, is about that and about his role in helping articulate a kind of anti-communist ideology that usually goes unnamed but is very widespread throughout the U.S. activist left, called revolutionary nonviolence. So he's a much more complicated character than is typically described in the mainstream media.
Well, let's talk about the ideas that he formulated. And you write, and you've just mentioned that much of this work took place at Harvard, at the Center for International Affairs. Tell us about how, and we'll then tease apart some of the many threads that you've mentioned in terms of his very outsized influence. But staying with nonviolence for a moment, how did he theorize nonviolence? I mean, he wrote a book about Gandhi that Albert Einstein wrote the introduction to. He was jailed for resisting the conscription of soldiers for the Korean War. How do you see the evolution of his ideas around nonviolence, and can you sum them up for us out of that mid-century pacifism, which, you know, Musty
right.
represents and was actually quite a large movement at the time?
Great question. So Gene Sharp is born in Ohio. He comes of age in the era of World War II, you know, and the Holocaust. It's clear it forms a very important part of his sort of political consciousness, or shapes his political consciousness to a good degree. And he would be described as this sort of conventional pacifist up until the late 50s. So he makes his way from working for Musty to working in London for this newsletter, Peace News. And from there, he's recruited by Arne Naas, who is himself a very interesting character, complicated character. He is the father of deep ecology. And he is known for sort of tangling with Murray Bookchin, father of social ecology, over some of the weaknesses of deep ecology. Anyhow, that's a different story. But Sharp is recruited by Arne Naas in the 50s to come and research nonviolence, and specifically the role of nonviolent action in resisting the Nazis in Norway. And so Sharp goes to the University of Oslo, and while there, at some point in the late 50s, early 60s, he meets a man named Thomas Schelling. And Thomas Schelling, he's not as famous as McGeorge Bundy or Henry Kissinger, but he is a very, very important nuclear strategist. And at the time, he's working for the RAND Corporation, but he's going to cycle through several administrations. And he is described by the Post as the man who made the Cold War what it was because of how influential his ideas about nuclear strategy were. So he is the developer of the Madman Theory of International Affairs, which is this theory that if you're trying to get the upper hand over your geopolitical opponent, you should act like a madman to throw your opponent sort of off balance. They aren't sure what you're going to do, and that gives you a certain kind of leverage. So you can imagine that this creates a bit of a volatile situation. Donald Trump actually has been described as using the madman theory of international affairs. So we have Schelling to thank. So Sharp and Schelling meet at some point in Norway, and Sharp gives Schelling his research, and Schelling is really impressed and invites Sharp to come to join him at this new interdisciplinary research outfit, the Center for International Affairs at Harvard. So this is a brand new center. It had just recently been founded. Like I mentioned earlier, it had been founded by McGeorge Bundy at the invitation of the Ford Foundation. The original co-directors are Kissinger and Bowie. Schelling is one of the very first few faculty members who is invited. And the list of people who are at the CIA, at Harvard, it's just a long string of Cold War luminaries. People like Raymond Vernon, who helped set up the International Monetary Fund and the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. He's sometimes called the father of globalization. Zbigniew Brzezinski, famously a mentor to Madeleine Albright. Samuel Huntington. Seymour
clash
Martin Lipset.
Mm-hmm.
Precisely, class of the Clash of Civilizations thesis. So I could go on and on. And then there's also the MIT Center for International Studies just down the road, and people like Walt Rostow, who's sort of the father of development studies, is there. So this is the milieu that Sharp would be entering. And it's, you know, very clearly the whole center's sort of mission is informed by the Cold War project. And Sharp accepts. And he would join in the mid-60s, and he would be there for 30 years and would call it his academic home. And I think it's in this time, probably, his association with Arne Naas and Thomas Schelling, because Naas himself actually was a member of XU, which is the Norwegian sort of secret intelligence services founded during World War II. So Naas has associations with this world as well. It's probably in this time, in the late 50s, early mid 60s, that Sharp pivots and starts distancing himself from pacifism per se, and starts describing nonviolent action as a method of conflict that is strategically superior to quote unquote violence. So he stands out in this way for theorizing what he calls political jujitsu, which is a method of conflict that employs not guns and bombs, but what he calls nonviolent action, which includes all different kinds of maneuvers. And he was very clear that, you know, this method of warfare could be used by good or bad forces. He was trying to sort of rationalize, kind of disembed nonviolence from any sort of political project, or ostensibly that's what he's trying to do, to make it, you know, cognizable to his audience, which at that time was the U.S. defense establishment, defense, security, and intelligence establishment, and try to make this, you know, try to make nonviolence attractive to them. And he has largely succeeded, I think, in that goal, actually. And to be clear, I think his purpose was for there to be less violence in the world. And under certain rubrics, you could say, well, you know, maybe he has succeeded. You know, we haven't had a conflagration like World War II since World War II. So, but how Sharp defines violence is sort of peculiar, right? And how the left thinks about violence, that's one of the areas where I think Sharp deserves a second look.
Well, can you explain that? How does he define violence? What's in it and what's not?
Yes. So to answer that question, I'll take a step back and first describe his social theory of power. So in the early 70s, he publishes his Politics of Nonviolent Action, which is a sort of three-volume magnum opus. And the first volume is dedicated to his political theory, his social theory of power, wherein he is trying to get at the sources, you know, what gives states power. And his answer, echoing Machiavelli, Rousseau, is that fundamentally a state's power rests on the consent of the governed. And this consent is not simply a sort of consent to the state. The consent is embodied in all different kinds of institutions, what eventually Sharp will term the pillars of power. So things like the media, religious institutions, educational institutions, all these institutions prop up the legitimacy and sort of represent the consent of the society. And so this is his social theory of power. And so he says, if you're trying to overturn a regime, you have to attack these pillars of power and sort of dissolve them, and then the regime will collapse. So it's interesting. He's sometimes called the Machiavelli of nonviolence, and it's true, except that he's kind of Machiavelli in reverse. He's interested in how to dissolve states, not so much how to build them, how to consolidate power or manipulate and use power, but in how to kind of, you know, trigger a process of entropy that will collapse them. So there's two ways in which Sharp thinks that this is going to advance nonviolence. Number one, the maneuvers that he is recommending as being most strategic to effecting this regime collapse are nonviolent. And really what he's saying is that the goal is to try to elicit a violent response from the state, basically. So You know, that's what he means by political jujitsu, is that, you know, you're going to, you know, force the state's hand, force a kind of overreaction. The role of the media is very important in this political strategy. You get the media to sort of expose the violence going on, and then public opinion, the opinion of public institutions, civic institutions, starts to shift. So Sharp is arguing that nonviolence is advanced, number one, because, you know, your nonviolent troops aren't, you know, they're using sit-ins as opposed to AK-47s. But then also he argues that this is, that this whole strategy is advancing nonviolence because he associates state centralization with violence. And this becomes much more clear in his book that I mentioned earlier, Social Power and Political Freedom, that for him, violence is, he defines it as any sort of direct injury. Okay, so there's this kind of directness element that I argue in the piece sort of obscures indirect forms of injury that we see under things like neoliberalism. And then furthermore, he argues that this kind of violence is intensified, it's exacerbated by there being a centralized state, centralized, i.e., having lots of regulation, control, public ownership within the economy. So he's arguing that if you can use his social theory of power, use his mechanism of nonviolent action to sort of reduce the state's power, you know, that this too is going to deliver a more nonviolent society, which, you know, I critique in the piece, you know, pointing out that there are many decentralized states that have utterly failed to deliver nonviolent, peaceful societies, the antebellum South being an excellent case in point.
I'm speaking with lawyer Marcy Smith. She's a lecturer in economics at John Jay College in New York City. And we're talking about her writing on Gene Sharp, the father of nonviolent strategy. My name is Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So the kind of theory that Sharp came up with about how to lead states to fall apart with nonviolent protest, to what degree was he formulating these ideas, as you mentioned, at Harvard's Center for International Affairs, with the Soviet Union in mind and the Eastern Bloc in mind, where ultimately some of his ideas would be taken up in protest?
Very much so. The Cold War and the Soviet Union are major themes that inform his work. So he, in 1983, founds the Albert Einstein Institution, as I mentioned. So this is in the context of Ronald Reagan having just been elected, rollback, communist rollback being the new foreign policy. And that same year, he is also granted a program at the CIA at Harvard, which, interestingly, in 1968, the CIA at Harvard had itself been target to a lot of anti-war demonstrations, and the Weather Underground even detonated a bomb there. And so in response, they changed their acronym first to the CFIA, and now they're called the Weatherhead Center. Anyhow, so in 1983, he is awarded given this new research center at the CFIA called the Program on Nonviolent Sanctions in Conflict and Defense. And under the aegis of this program, he published a book called Making Europe Unconquerable, The Potential of Civilian-Based Deterrence and Defense. And this book was very explicitly directed at a NATO audience, trying to make the case that nonviolent action would be a good strategy for trying to, number one, defend from Soviet aggression, but also he talks in the book about how there's offensive applications, and members of NATO could do things like translate guides on nonviolent action and disseminate them within the Soviet Union, provide monies to groups using these ideas, and so on and so forth. So George Kennan, in fact, wrote the foreword to that book, Father of the Cold War, you know, sort of with his imprimatur, kind of approves of these ideas, even though, you know, Kennan was not, at the time, within any formal role. Still, This is a sort of signal of the seriousness with which Sharpe's ideas are taken. So certainly his theories are developed, his ideas are developed with this geopolitical context in mind. And then with the founding of the Albert Einstein Institution in 83, him and Peter Ackerman and company start working to actually apply these ideas around the world. And one of the first places where they do so is within the USSR. So at the end of the 80s, they begin corresponding with the separatist movements in Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. And, you know, it's worth noting that the NED, National Endowment for Democracy, which also had been founded in 83, is funding elements of these movements. So Sharpe and Ackerman are corresponding with them. And then many of your listeners will remember that in 1990, there's this wave of secession. So Lithuania is the first to declare their secession from the USSR. And predictably, the Soviet troops counter and roll into Lithuania. So in this moment of power struggle, Sharpe and Ackerman actually make a personal visit to the Baltics, and they actually consult with the president, defense minister, military personnel, et cetera, within Lithuania. And they draft a study guide on nonviolent action for the Lithuanian Defense Department. And they manage to help the Lithuanians force the Soviets to retreat. And for this, a member of the Lithuanian secessionist movement has said that, quote, "I would rather have Sharpe's book, Civilian-Based Defense, than the nuclear bomb." So this was really decisive. So Baltic secession was very destabilizing to the USSR, and there's also, you know, there's multiple things going on. The USSR has internal contradictions. Also, there's a sort of currency war being waged against the ruble by Western banks. And so in this tailspin, in November and December of 1991, Sharpe and Ackerman actually go and conduct another three-week consulting trip to the Baltics and to Russia, and are there actually up until the very day before the final dissolution of the USSR. So this is a major victory for the Albert Einstein Institution, for Sharpe, and for the sort of intellectual and activist movement that has been congealing around Sharpe since the late 70s.
Can you give us some other examples of countries where protesters have taken up Sharpe's ideas and even been more directly helped by the Albert Einstein Institute?
Yes. Well, the next very big example is Yugoslavia. So AEI is instrumental to training OTPOR, which is the youth movement which toppled Slobodan Milosevic. So the U.S. has been trying to oust Milosevic for some time, but it's ultimately only with the nonviolent kind of agitation, the nonviolent protest movement, OTPOR, that Milosevic is ultimately overthrown. Milosevic is ultimately unseated in September 2000, but OTPOR, yes, begins in the late 90s. And very interestingly, so after Milosevic is overthrown, two of the key OTPOR leaders found a training outfit of their own. So the first big achievement of this group, which is called CANVAS, the Center for Applied Nonviolent Action and Strategies, is in Georgia. I should mention that these two Sharpian trainees who start CANVAS are Popovic and Genovic are their names. So they initially train Kamara enough in Georgia. They're at the time opposing Shevardnadze, Eduardo Shevardnadze, and Kamara gets, you know, money from the Soros Open Society Institute and are, you know, calling very much as the activists in the Baltic secession movements did and like OTPOR did for, you know, an open society, for democratic freedoms. And we see a similar thing happen again in the Ukraine. And in each of these cases, it's worth noting that the public had good reason to want change. But the pattern that we see time and again is that the demands for improved economic conditions or more government transparency don't actually get met. And instead, what happens is that this creates an opening for neoliberal economic restructuring. And so certainly in the case of the USSR with, you know, Yeltsin's famous shock therapy, in the case of Yugoslavia, I mean, which is we're still seeing the sort of the economic effects of that. And then with both Georgia and Ukraine, we see the pattern, the ousted leaders are either resisting the U.S.'s sort of geopolitical goals in the Middle East, or they're, you know, thwarting privatization efforts that the IMF is making, and they get overthrown, and the folks who come in, deregulate health insurance or privatize health insurance, so on and so forth. That's just, one example from the Ukraine instance. So the pattern is clear in these instances, and we can also see that Sharpe's ideas spread beyond just those particular places where him or his trainees are directly training people on the ground. Sharpe's ideas were all throughout the Arab Spring. We can see them on display in the Hong Kong protests. And in each of these cases, again, there is often very legitimate grievance. So the question becomes, why so often is the outcome, less than desirable?
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Today I'm speaking with Marcy Smith about her two-part extended essay, Change Agent, Jean Sharpe's Neoliberal Nonviolence. You can find a link to those essays on againstthegrain.org. Jean Sharpe, of course, is the influential intellectual who helped develop multiple theories or interlocking theories of nonviolence, and his influence has been enormous in scope. So speaking of that influence, tell us about Sharpe's influence in Venezuela during the time of Hugo Chavez and the fallout from those.
Yes. So as I mentioned, the organization Canvas is founded by two of Sharpe's trainees who, among their significant achievements, if we'll call them that, was training Camara, the Georgian youth organization, which was opposing Shevardnadze in the early 2000s. Shevardnadze is overthrown. I should mention also that he's replaced with Chacas Vaily, who's a Columbia Law graduate, and among other things, reestablished a good relationship with the IMF, privatized public hospitals, increased military spending, signed the Economic Liberty Act, which restricted the state's ability to act within the economy. So this is Canvas, and tellingly, one of their co-founders is what was a few years ago discovered to have very close relationships and lots of email correspondence with Stratfor, the private intelligence outfit, and WikiLeaks exposed that story. So they basically try to repeat this model in Venezuela in 2005. So 2003, there was this failed military coup against Chavez, which had been blessed by Washington. And as all your listeners will know, Chavez was a social democratic leader, and he was driving Washington and the West crazy. And there have been efforts to oust him for some time. But there's this very important effort in 2003 to overthrow him by military means, and it fails. And in the wake of that, the Albert Einstein Institution actually sends Bob Helvey, whom I mentioned earlier, comes out of defense intelligence and is an AEI consultant, sends him to spend 9 days consulting with anti-Chavez activists. Despite this, Chavez wins in 2004. The U.S. via the National Endowment for Democracy and USAID continue pouring money into Venezuela and are calling for a recall referendum, which is granted, and Chavez wins that as well. And at this moment, there's more scrutiny. It's sort of, what's going on in Venezuela, and even certain mainstream outlets like the Times are sort of conceding that the United States, you know, knew about the coup effort in 2003. And in 2007, there's a Venezuelan-American attorney named Ivor Gollinger who publishes a book called Bush versus Chavez, Washington's War on Venezuela. And in it, she talks about the role that the Albert Einstein Institution played in training some of these anti-Chavez activists in the wake of the coup. Kind of from this moment, the accusations globally start compounding. And so, the Asia Times sort of calls Sharp the concertmaster of a failed color revolution effort in Burma. In Iran, Ahmadinejad's Ministry of Propaganda makes this sort of this video of John McCain and George Soros and Gene Sharp all conspiring in the White House against Iran. This is sort of the mood. And that year, Sharp's defenders respond. And so led by Stephen Zunis, who's a professor at the University of San Francisco here, wrote an open letter defending Sharp's virtue and trustworthiness, along with the Albert Einstein Institution's Popovic's canvas, as well as at this point, Peter Ackerman has spun off a new group. So defending Ackerman and his new group. And they get a lot of signatories, including Howard Zinn and Noam Chomsky, Daniel Ellsberg. And in pretty dramatic language, it says, you know, these signatories categorically reject the false accusations that Sharp engaged in activities designed to promote U.S. imperialism. They make pretty big claims. They say that AEI's financial flows are clean of government money, except for receiving a couple of small one-time grants from the NED and the International Republican Institute for translation projects. They've never gotten any money from the government or government-funded entities. From my research, this is not true, actually, from Albert Einstein Institution's own annual reports. The IRI, the NED, and other outfits like the U.S. Institute for Peace gave money to the Albert Einstein Institution for much more than small translation projects. So sort of incredibly, this open letter didn't deal with any of the contradictions that I feel like I've raised in my research, but instead kind of recommitted to this narrative about Sharp that he is very simply, without caveat, a friend to social movements on the left globally.
Well, and yet the people who signed on, and including Stephen Zunis, are people of the left. So why do you think there is this gap between what you're saying is all of Sharp's history, even beyond the funding, and then how he's seen on the left? I mean, I imagine there will be those who might say, well, on some level, we might not like Sharp's history or his associations, but these ideas are useful ideas without a politics attached to them. Why can't we claim these ideas for the left, or maybe more accurately, more for progressive movements, without having to then take on all of that baggage, which may be particular to him?
Mm-hmm. Totally. So the main argument in my second piece has to do, my second part of the essay has to do with this point. So you're absolutely right that the money is the least of it. And there have actually been, before me, criticisms of Sharp Rays that I think probably focus a bit too much on trying to find the sort of smoking gun, you know, pay stub from the CIA proving that Sharp is an intelligence asset. And that's not the nature of my argument. I think that the story is, frankly, more interesting than that. So definitely part of the argument that is made as to Sharp's utility for the left is that he's secular. He is just offering strategy and tactics, and that's it. Most people who have been on the left in the past several decades, who have been involved with any sort of social movement or protest movement, will have experienced nonviolent direct action trainings, some sort of training session where you are given the skills of nonviolent protest. And what you'll notice in many of these trainings is that they are, quote unquote, secular. They appear to be, right? That there's no ideology that is explicitly being discussed. There's no kind of political program that is being emphasized. It's just, you know, tactics and sometimes strategy. You're just learning skills. So in part two, I talk about the spread of Sharpe's ideas, you know, not just internationally as we see them in the color revolutions, but domestically, because I argue that Jean Sharpe is a very, very important intellectual leader in the U.S. activist left today. Whether or not activists know that they're using his ideas are really all over the place. So why is this an issue? Because, as I argue, that Sharpe's ideas are actually a sort of means to introducing activists to an ideology. And the ideology is very rarely named as such, but it is very clearly internally consistent, internally coherent worldview called revolutionary nonviolence. And in this moment, it's really important to understand what revolutionary nonviolence is, because it was conceived of in the early and mid 20th century as a sort of anti-communist alternative, radical alternative to Marxism, to a kind of class-informed political consciousness. And revolutionary nonviolence has a very, at best, sort of ambivalent attitude toward political strategies that take aim at state power. Notice that, you know, for Jean Sharpe, the state's always the enemy. There's never any effort necessarily to take over the state, right? It's always, how do we collapse the state? The state is the big enemy. There's no discussion in his social theory of power about production, about class. You know, why is that? If you like read between the lines throughout his work and throughout the work of adjacent intellectuals, it's clear that part of the reason is because class allegiance isn't so consistent. You know, there are a number of, you know, Bob Helby, for example, in some of his interviews, it's clear that his identification, he identifies as a member of the capitalist class. So Jean Sharpe, I think, certainly can be used, provided that we are able to identify the ideological tradition that he comes out of. Because if we are just studying him and training ourselves in his methods without being aware of the subtle and not so subtle ways that his ideological posture shapes his tactics and strategy, then we could very easily find ourselves in the kind of political cul-de-sac that activists using his ideas have again and again.
You write that contained within Jean Sharpe's writings is a rejection of mass politics. And I wanted to ask you why you argue that.
The rejection of mass politics, I think we see most clearly in the Movement for a New Society. So this is, the Movement for a New Society is one of the principal topics of the second part of my essay. So I've said that Jean Sharpe has played a really important role in the U.S. activist left. How has that come to be? Principally through the activities of this small organization, the Movement for a New Society, founded in 1971 as a kind of cadre organization to promote nonviolent revolution, which, again, sounds, you know, nice enough and simple enough, but for Movement for a New Society in this revolutionary nonviolence tradition, it means something very particular. It's invoking this whole ideology. So MNS, as it's called, is founded by a group of Quakers who are coming out of anti-Vietnam War protests. And one of their key founders is George Lakey, who continues to be a major activist trainer. And him and Sharpe got to know each other in Norway back when Sharpe was there. Lakey was there because he'd married a woman from Norway. So they meet and become lifelong intellectual sort of companions, and Lakey becomes a kind of mentee of Sharpe's. But likewise, Sharpe uses a lot of Lakey's intellectual work. Lakey has written several books. So the Movement for a New Society, they set out to train social movements within the United States in the methods of nonviolent action. They train the anti-nuclear movement, train the activists of the Seabrook protests. They'll go on to train lots of elements of the women's movement, the Central American, Latin American solidarity movement. And though they disbanded in the 80s, their alumni have started new training outfits. Lakey started training for change. In the article, I kind of discuss this, the kind of pattern of descent. But today, for example, with the Momentum Training organization, which has trained lots of social movements that we read about in the press every day, Sharpe's ideas are foundational to these training protocols. And so when we look at Movement for a New Society's history, I think we see some of the contradictions that emerge when within revolutionary nonviolence, which Jean Sharpe is so key to legitimizing for activists, right? Because it's, you know, this is supposed to be a secular argument as to why nonviolent action is more strategic than violence. And one of the things we see is this ambivalence about the state, as I've mentioned. You know, Movement for a New Society was very clearly opposed to this idea of taking state power. Their goal was to try to collapse all states globally and then introduce some sort of worldwide government that wouldn't be a state. It's ambiguous and not very credible in my view. They're very sort of ambivalent about class. This is another hallmark of revolutionary nonviolence, is, you know, this sort of ambivalence about organizing at the point of production, promoting class consciousness. Instead, they promoted cross-class movements. And instead of talking about class, they would talk about classism, sort of interclass prejudice. And then they also, back to your question about mass politics, they had a kind of discomfort with mass politics because they said that it, the implication seemed to be that there was kind of an authoritarian risk here, you know, and that mass politics would deprive movements of a kind of cultural richness. And what we practically see then is a kind of activist cadre strategy. And we see this in the places where Sharpe's ideas have been operationalized. You know, that these aren't necessarily, you know, mass movements per se. They're movements of lots of activists doing very visible things that are being captured by the media. So it looks like there's a very broad-based movement. But, you know, even today, Sharpians in the press will often emphasize that you don't need all that many people engaged in a nonviolent rebellion in order for it to succeed. So that's a kind of odd thing, you know, to say we don't actually need all that many people. We just need a handful in order to get sort of the optics right, in order to undercut legitimacy for the regime, and it'll collapse.
In terms of the legacy that you're laying out, and you expand in it further in your essay on Jean Sharpe about the influence of his ideas on activism today, and one of the things you do flag is a certain valorization of change without, you know, the question answered, change for what, and a certain anti-intellectualism. But just staying for a moment on the question of the state, certainly there are critiques of the state from the left that are very different than those on the right. I mean, the idea of the state in Life After Capitalism is quite different than talking about the state as it is under capitalism. Certainly listeners might think, but, you know, the state can be repressive. There's all sorts of problems with the capitalist state. Why shouldn't we be against the capitalist state? Is the point here that you feel like it dovetails with a certain kind of neoliberal agenda that is deregulatory and so on? Mm-hmm. Because obviously the left-wing critique of the state has a long and venerable tradition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so definitely part of my critique is one of libertarianism, and in part one, especially, I point out the, just as you said, the ways in which revolutionary nonviolence and Sharpe's contributions to it dovetail very nicely with sort of the actual historical trajectory of neoliberalism, regardless of what the intention was. In fact, it corresponded very nicely. But I do have personally more fundamental critiques of libertarianism as well as libertarian socialism. And I think one of the strongest pieces of evidence that I lay out for that critique is Movement for a New Society's vision of what their post-state world looks like. So George Lakey wrote this book called Strategy for a Living Revolution, which very similar to Sharp's work, is read by activists still across the country. And it's very, it ends in a very ironic way. So Lakey, like Sharp, has spent the book warning against centralized states and warning about following leftists who would seek to take them over, like Bernie Sanders. But then at the end, he does this really amazing, almost kind of like Return of the Repressed, where he proposes a kind of expert-driven world state. He doesn't use the word state, but he talks about how there would be a suite of transnational institutions that would be led by respected and public-spirited experts who would make humankind-sized decisions, and how their decisions would be, quote, supreme. He concedes that, quote, the question of enforcement of decisions remains an awkward one, and recognizes there would need to be probably local police, world marshals, a world ombudsman, which is kind of like a prosecutor. He says that eventually there would be a world legislature, but he says, you know, such bodies would come, quote, at a late stage of development because the revolutionary process is ragged and uneven. Right.
And Lakey, if I'm not mistaken, has come out in recent years as a supporter of Scandinavian social democracy, which is also
absolutely
not anti-statist.
And this is a weird contradiction because that's not new. Lakey has been talking about how he likes Scandinavian social democracy for many years. His first version of this book was published in the 70s, and he was talking about Scandinavian social democracy then. So this is a very peculiar contradiction that he has, that on the one hand, Scandinavian social democracy is okay, and yet everywhere else throughout the literature, you know, there's this sort of very unambiguous anti-state posture.
I'm afraid we're entirely out of
okay.
time. Marcy Smith, I want to thank you so
yes,
much.
Yes, thank you.
I've been speaking with Marcy Smith. She is lecturer in economics at John Jay College in New York City. She's also a lawyer. And she's the author of the two-part extended essay, Change Agent, Gene Sharp's Neoliberal Nonviolence, on the website nonsite.org. You can find a direct link to the essays on againstthegrain.org. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time.